Welcome to everyone. Our first case this morning is State v. James E. McWilliams. Ms. Stover, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this is a case where we've alleged prosecutorial misconduct and some ineffective assistance of counsel. I think I first want to address the prosecutorial misconduct as this Court has dealt with it a number of times in the last years. But obviously, the first case would be McSwine. It's the case in which there was a one-time statement made in closing by the prosecutor. And the Court of Appeals found that it was misconduct. This Court reversed and found that he didn't refer to anything that was actually in evidence, so that it wasn't misconduct. In this case, in McWilliams, I would submit that the prosecutor incorrectly detailed the facts that were in evidence, so and he did it many times, extensive versus isolated. I think it rises to the level of violating Mr. McWilliams' due process rights. In reviewing the claim with this prosecutorial misconduct, the Court looks at a number of things, one of them being whether these statements were extensive or isolated. In the present case, again, I would say that they were extensive. There's not one, not two, but there are about six times that the prosecutor misrepresents what was presented in the evidence.
What specifically, if you can, were those misrepresentations?
Well, the first, I detailed them in the brief, but I think the first one was when the prosecutor said that this happened all of a sudden. And if you look at the testimony, especially of Ms. Johnson, she encountered them two or three times, saw them talking, heard the woman giggling, and then the prosecutor went on to say that there was no talking. And again, Ms. Johnson heard them having a conversation, heard him say something, she spoke to the male. There was talking and there was some laughing and stuff. I think that that's just a misrepresentation. And he also said there was no action on part of the victim to reciprocate, but yet there's testimony that they were holding hands. Again, they were laughing, and she was not. There's some testimony that it just looked like they were two drunk people having sex. That's what at least two of the witnesses said.
So are these material misrepresentations?
Well, I think they are material in that the way that he puts it together, it's almost as if he says it was, you know, they met at the door and 30 seconds later he's got her undressed and she's completely passed out, and I don't think that that was the case. I think that it was, I mean, there was a lot more time involved, and there were a number of witnesses, which also took time. There's also an issue about, I know that the prosecutor said she didn't, her pants were down, and if she had been with it, she would have pulled her pants up, and yet there's one officer. The first officer that shows up sees her and her shorts are down by her knees. But within minutes, I think within about 1 minute, there was another officer that showed up and her shorts were pulled up, which to me indicates that she pulled her shorts up, had enough wherewithal to do that. As far as the ineffectiveness, your court has addressed this a couple times. I know on January 20th you had two post-convictions that came down, and they both had prosecutorial misconduct in them. And I think that, again, the difference between those cases and this case is that there were extensive statements made in this case versus in Williams, I believe, there was one isolated statement. I think the prosecutor used the word punk, and that actually accurately describes something that was in evidence. The things that Prosecutor McWilliams described were not reflective of what was in evidence. You also ruled the same day, State v. Eli, that the defendant prosecutor can draw inferences from the evidence. But I think here, the remarks made by the prosecutor were, I think they rise above the level of inference. I think that they are basically changing what the evidence was.
What were those remarks?
Well, again, back to the not pulling her pants up, all of a sudden, there was no talking. And the evidence shows that there was talking, according to a couple of the witnesses. There was talking.
Was the testimony inconsistent?
With what the prosecutor said?
No, by the witnesses. Were there inconsistencies within the witness testimonies?
There were some inconsistencies.
Were there some testimonies that supported what the prosecutor said?
Towards the end, yes, there are witnesses at the end that support that. There were two or three, I believe, that said that they didn't think it was a big deal. One of them said they thought it was consensual until, and testified that it was consensual until the officers told him it was actually an assault. So I think that shows that there's some inconsistencies there. There was another witness that thought they were just two drunk people active in the alley. I think the prosecutor put together a story that did not reflect what the actual evidence was. There was a lot, I mean, there was eyewitnesses here. There were three of them that had her in different positions, on her back, on her side, on her stomach. Prosecutor said, you know, if she'd been with it, she would have repositioned herself if there was some sort of pain, I guess. I'm not sure. But there's no consistency as far as the position that she was in. So, again, I also point out the ineffectiveness, and that's trial counsel did not object in closing, and he didn't move for a motion to mistrial. But you can still find plain error here, I think, because the jury instructions told the jury that the arguments were not evidence, so that's true. And the jury instructions were absolutely adequate. But there was no curative instruction. Had defense counsel made an objection or motion for mistrial, the court could have given a curative instruction to alleviate that problem. He was not able to because there was no objection.
Counsel, did the defense's closing argument call out the inconsistencies that you're describing?
It did not. So we would ask that the court find that this did affect the defendant's right and a miscarriage of justice was had.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm Assistant Attorney General and I represent the Appalachians in Nebraska. Williams' primary assignment of error on appeal is that the district court erred in denying his motion for a new trial based on prosecutorial and witness misconduct. He first claims the prosecutor repeatedly misstated the evidence during closing arguments, which in turn materially affected his substantial rights. I disagree. I have addressed each of the challenged remarks in my brief, and I don't intend to do so again here, but suffice it to say that I see nothing wrong with the prosecutor's remarks in this case. They either accurately reflected or were based or reasonably inferred from the evidence adduced at trial. Moreover, all of the alleged misstatements noted by McWilliams were relatively minor and in no way misled the jury. There was no prosecutorial misconduct, nor was there any witness misconduct. Investigator Moore's testimony at the preliminary hearing was internally inconsistent. He twice said that the victim learned about the sexual assault after the fact, meaning later, but then said that she independently recalled being assaulted. Well, both cannot be true. It's either one or the other. And when he was convicted, when he was confronted with the inconsistency at trial, he simply acknowledged that he didn't know which one was correct. However, it's clear from the other evidence adduced at trial that it was the former. The victim knew she had been sexually assaulted only because she had been told by law enforcement and because she had certain physical after effects from the assault, bruises, the abrasions, the soreness, etc. In any event, prior inconsistent statements, like the ones at issue here, typically provide fodder for impeachment, not grounds for a mistrial or a new trial. McWilliams' counsel did exactly what he should have done. He exposed the inconsistency and then left it to the jury to determine what, if any, weight to give the officer's testimony. There was no misconduct. And because there was no misconduct, either witness or prosecutorial, the district court did not err, denying this motion for a new trial. McWilliams also alleges 10 claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. Like the prosecutor's remarks, I have addressed each of those claims in brief. I do not intend to go through each one individually here. With the exception of one claim that cannot be resolved on the record before this court, I believe most, if not all, of his claims fail due to lack of deficient performance. As a practical matter, this case was very difficult to defend. Sexual assaults do not typically occur out in the open with multiple witnesses. It is rare to have evidence of this quality and this amount in a sexual assault case. But given the sheer number of witnesses and the continuous chain of events to which they testified, it is difficult to see any prejudice suffered by Williams due to his, as a result of his counsel's alleged performance. But unless the court has any specific questions about any of the effective assistance claims, I'll submit those on brief along with this claim of excessive sentence.
I think in your argument, you alluded to defense counsel's closing argument. I had asked your opponent about defense counsel's closing argument and without characterizing her response, how would you respond to the same question?
Your Honor, to be perfectly honest with you, it's been so long. I take notes on those things, and I took specific note of the one comment that he alleged ineffective assistance counsel on, so I don't remember exactly what his arguments were. I tried to counter all of them. I know he did argue.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's all right.
What's the state's position with respect to the pro se brief that's been filed in this court?
Well, I went ahead and responded to them because if I'm not mistaken, I think he filed a motion with the Court of Appeals asking for permission. I was not served with that motion. I probably would have objected. But they allowed it, and so granted him permission. I went ahead and addressed those claims. Question whether that proper, it seems to me that he's represented by counsel, he can fire his attorney on or counsel. I see why we should have to defend.
Are most of those claims redundant?
Some of them were. I believe there were only three that were raised in the attorney's brief. Conduct in there that's not couched in terms of effective assistance. So there were additional claims. In fact, the bulk of the effective assistance counsel claims are addressed to his pro se brief. Well, if there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
2 minutes and 1 second.
2 minutes and 1 second, Ms. Stover.
Hopefully, I'll take 2 minutes and 1 second. As far as the pro se brief, McWilliams, did address a number of things that I did not, and I did not specifically.
Thank you for your service. The next case of the day is White versus State.